be talking with a film director from the Philippines, who's on a project right now to uncover the past, uncover a bad past, a kind of atrocious past of U.S. atrocities in the Philippines about 100 years ago, as the U.S. now returns to the Philippines in this war of terrorism. But 100 years ago, about 100 years ago, there was a massacre there, different massacres that the U.S. military engaged in. So we're going to hear from film director Hill Portes about what went on 100 years ago. This is Subversity here with Dan Zhang here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, how are you? I have 1,000 brilliant lies for the question, what is God? If you think that the truth can be known from words, if you think that the sun and the ocean can pass through that tiny opening called the mouth, well, someone should start laughing. Someone should start wildly laughing now. It happens all the time in heaven, and someday it will begin to happen again on earth, that men and women who are married, and men who are lovers, and women who give each other light, often will get down on their knees, and while so tenderly holding their lover's hand, with tears in their eyes, will sincerely speak, saying, "My dear, how can I be more loving to you? How can I be more kind?"
You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. We're going to go to our interview with Hill Portes now, and we asked him why he was interested, or is he really interested in making historical films, or making history come alive? And this is what he had to say.
Yes, of course. In every film we make, I try to include or to dramatize a portion of events, contemporary or past events, that took place in my country, events that are relevant to what we're doing right now, or events that are related to the contemporary events.
Do you think that young people are forgetting their history?
Yes. Young people are no longer interested in our history. Times have changed in my country, and the young have forgotten what happened in the past, and they should be constantly reminded that once upon a time we were like this, and we can only be more progressive, and we can only move on if we will look back and learn some lessons from the past.
Do you feel that they that the history is being rewritten so that people aren't learning the right lessons from it?
I don't understand.
I mean, like you said, the young people don't seem to know the history, but the history they do learn in schools, what does that teach them?
Well, I may be wrong, but I think the history lessons that they are learning in school right now are from books which were written decades ago. Most of these books are antiquated, you know. Most of these books are not updated to serve the contemporary needs of the young people. So books should be written, new learning materials should be created, so they will get to know or they will have a better perspective of what happened before and what can happen now.
Do you think being a filmmaker, that using film is a particularly useful way to awaken historical consciousness?
Most certainly, film is a very powerful medium, and majority of the audience or the movie-going public in the country are young people. So film can be used as an instrument to I hate to use the word to inform, because for me a film should not be used as a propaganda material, but you know, film can be used to dramatize events or situations that took place in the past that are still relevant to the contemporary situation in the country.
So you don't think of it just as an entertainment value?
Of course. But as I said, film should not be a propaganda tool. It should not be preachy, or you should not even aim to teach a moral lesson. But if in the process you teach them some lessons that are related to events happening now, then it's good. But you know, the filmmaker should be very, very careful in presenting events or situations. And they can be accused of doing propaganda stuff, you know. That can be very, very dangerous.
You know what? You don't believe in film just being like escapist stuff?
No, I don't. Film should not be treated like basically an escape mechanism. For me, film should not really teach more a lesson, but it should create a certain amount of awareness. But in the process, it should not be preachy. It should not, you know what I mean. Films,
it should tell a good story.
Yeah, exactly. And it should entertain.
Yeah.
But entertainment comes in varied forms. No, entertainment is, you know, can be fierce laughter, sexual arousement. If you,
right.
You can be aroused by a passionate lampstand. And that, it, I don't mean propaganda, pornography. But it should be delicately handled, because it is a very, very powerful medium.
In the Philippines, why was the film In the Bosom of the Enemy, why did they treat that like an adult film?
It was rated by the Census Board as an adult movie because of the lab scenes and the nudity that was, although integral to the film, But they did not expect 7-year-old to, you know, to appreciate or to like the film. So it was given the R rating, which is restricted 18-year-old app.
But that didn't affect the success, huh?
No, it did not. Because when we planned the film, it was really geared for a mature audience.
You came up, you said you based this story on something your mother told you.
Yes, my mom used to tell me the story of a friend who was a wet nurse to a Japanese infant during the war. And, you know, because even most of my films are really originated from stories that I heard, you know, when I was growing up, or stories that I hear now. And, of course, I enhanced this, and I put some trimmings here and there. So that story of my mother, you know, stick in my mind. And as I mentioned before, no, years ago, I was in St. Petersburg, and I was visiting the Palace of the Tsar, which the Hermitage, you know, and I saw this powerful painting by Artemiso, an Italian, you know, painter. And there was this scene there that really struck me. A young mother breastfeeding his father, who was on his way to the guillotine, and I said, oh my God, what a powerful image. And I remember what my mother was telling me about the wet nurse. And I said, I can relate this to that story. And I was walking, you know, I was touring, you know, the Hermitage. I was there for 4 hours. And after 4 hours, I had this story.
Do you write your own script?
Sometimes I write my own script, but I always collaborate with the writer.
So in this case, you picked this really handsome guy to play the Japanese officer. Was that just pure chance you found him?
Well, we were so desperate. We were looking for a real Japanese, but we couldn't afford someone from Japan because budget is really, really limited. So a talent agent called me up one morning and told me that there is a guy who is actually a Filipino, but he looks like a Japanese. He grew up in Tokyo and Vancouver, speaks Tagalog, and he speaks fluent Japanese. He was on his way to Singapore to do some modeling, and he's spending some days in Manila. And I told the talent agent, can I see him? And, you know, when he popped in, I told myself that I found my Japanese.
So he was perfect?
Yes, he's perfect.
So actually, but he knew Japanese, right?
Yes. Yeah. Speaks fluent Japanese.
So he's actually the grandson of a former president.
Yes, he is the grandson of José Laurel. And coincidentally, President Laurel was the president of the country during the Japanese occupation. And he was even accused of being a collaborator, but that's not really true.
So this guy actually lived in Japan during the war? This actor? Yeah.
No. He was born after the war.
He was born after the war.
You know, he's young. Kenji's in his mid-20s, you know. Actually, his father, I mean, his real grandfather, because, you know, the president of the Philippines was the brother of his real grandfather. But he's also a grandfather, you know. He's the brother of the president, was the ambassador to Japan for many, many years. And Kenji, and that's not his real name, was very close to his to the ambassador. So he lived with him in Japan.
So why did you have to use a Japanese name for him?
Oh, to give it the Japanese flavor. It's basically a marketing decision. You know, because if you use his real name or a Filipino name, and then people say, oh, he's not a Japanese, nobody will believe him. So when you have a name like Kenji Motoki, you know, people, you know, will really pay attention.
So, but he's a model now?
Yeah, and he's still acting.
But does the actor know his regular name or his...
No, no, he's decided to use Kanji as his screen name.
So what's his real name?
Jose Maria Laurel Marquez.
So is he, did this help him promote his career, this
yes.
film?
Yeah, the film was a big boost to his popularity. But of course, his roles will always be limited because, you know, he looks Japanese, you know. The roles that will be given to him are, well, if not Chinese, are Oriental roles, no, because, you know, Filipinos have a different... Excuse me, Filipinos look differently from the Chinese and the Japanese because of our, you know, Spanish, you know, heritage and to a certain extent the American heritage.
Does he always play bad guy roles now?
I don't think so.
Yeah, in this film, you treated this Japanese officer rather sympathetically. And were you afraid that the audience wouldn't accept this?
No. He was accepted as a sympathetic Japanese.
So the memory of the war is receding. I mean, you're saying in the other film, in the Makoga Comfort Gay, you show Filipino girls getting ready to go to Japan to work in the entertainment industry there. So there is a lot of, kind of exchange between Japan and Philippines. So even though the Japanese were like really sadistic and brutal during World War II, people don't remember that.
Well, as I mentioned before, the memories of the war are gone, and Filipinos forget easily. We send our young women to Japan to work as entertainers. And they contribute, these women contribute a lot to the economy of the country. They send back, you know, the precious yen that they earn in Japan. Actually, before it was the American dollar that used to dominate the economy, but not anymore, you know. With the thousands of Japanese women in Japan working as entertainers, so the yen is getting to be a powerful threat to the American dollar.
Even though the Japanese economy is not that good right now.
Yes, because actually it doesn't affect the export of entertainers to Japan. You know very well that, you know, when the economic situation is bad, people tend to go to, you know, to entertainment, you know. Not necessarily movies but they flock in Japan, they flock to bars, you know, to nightclubs, karaoke, and, you know, these Filipino women are born to be, you know, good entertainers.
So people try to escape their worries.
Yeah.
They try to escape their worries, and they do it through this young and beautiful Filipino women. God knows what they do in Japan.
I can imagine. In your film, you depict this house of golden gays, like kind of golden girls living in retirement. But in one scene, you actually show them with some young guys that they've paid for in advance, one of the people say, one of the gays says. Is that very common? Is that very easy to...
Well, that situation is common, but the golden gaze is not common. You know, I was really amazed when I found out that there is a house like this. You know, it's run by a counselor. I do not know if the counselor is gay. No, but you know. He told me that one time he saw these dried up old gays, you know, nowhere to go, or, you know, no longer welcome in their own home. So he decided to, you know, to invite them to, you know, to spend the night. And Then one night became two, three nights, and before he knew it, they were there. So it's not officially known, actually, as the Golden Gaze home, but, you know, it's it started as a joke, the word Golden Gaze. It, you know, obviously it's from Golden Girls, no, but, you know, they call themselves the residents of the Golden Gaze. But I do not know if it is officially registered as a Golden Gaze home.
But, you know, the, I mean, I think that's very interesting because I think most of the, I don't know if there's the retirement homes. I think at one point, gay people here were thinking of taking over, like a town and making that a gay town in some Northern California somewhere. But I don't know if that succeeded. But in terms of male prostitution, is there a crackdown now because of Americans, like saying, you know, that this is bad and immoral and stuff? I heard that there were some people arrested, you know, foreigners, and then sent back to their country in Germany or whatever. Is that still going on, or do you know?
Well, yes, it's still going on. Foreigners, pedophiles, I heard, are still, you know, coming over to lure the kids, you know, into male prostitution. You know, this will not go away because, you know, when the country's poor, it's a question of economy. You know, here comes a foreign invader with lots and lots of money, and parents don't really care as long as they get the money because they're not thinking that, you know, these are boys. Whatever happens to them, they will still be boys. You know, they will not get pregnant. You know, they're not thinking of the adverse effects on their, you know, psychological makeup. You know,
but you know, like films like Macho Dancer and Midnight Dancer show that the audience is really Filipino, not foreign tourists. Is that true?
Well, yes, but most of the pedophiles who were arrested, who are still present in the country, are foreigners.
But they don't, the police don't arrest Filipinos.
I haven't heard of a Filipino being arrested. You know, because, you know, you're not breaking any law. Like, for example, if you go to a gay bar and watch, you know, dancers, male strippers, you know, as long as you're of age, you know, you're not violating any law.
But the dancers, is there a restriction on how old they have to be?
Well, they should not be there if they're below 18, but, you know, people can circumvent the law.
People look younger sometimes.
Yeah.
But I know that some dancers are below 18. But, you know, the police can be corrupted, yeah. You know, and all this can happen in a poor country like the Philippines. You know, money talks. You know.
Yeah. So how do you fund your films? Do you get, as an independent filmmaker, is it hard to compete with other filmmakers, or is there enough enterprise to go around or support to go around?
Well, it is really tough to be an independent filmmaker in the country, but I didn't plan to be an independent filmmaker. When I started doing films, I was thinking of talking to big studios, offering them projects, but somehow it didn't work. Well, although I do films every now and then, you know, with the major studios, I am actually in the middle of the door. My right foot is, you know, in the mainstream, and my left foot is in the independent sector of the industry. But I'm quite successful in raising money for the films that I really like to do. So I said, oh, I'll forget all this, you know, commercial producers, and just do it the way I think it should be done. So I raise money. I conceive my projects, and as a result, I don't compromise. I do films that I really like to do, but there is always a disadvantage, because when you go to the theaters to show your film, then you don't get the best deals, actually, you know, because you have only one film. On the other hand, the big studio or the commercial producer can offer several titles to the theaters. So that is the disadvantage. But my films are low budget, easily, it can, not easily, but you know, that my films can be very profitable if it's marketed well. And my films are also targeted to be shown outside of the country, because you know, most of the producers in the country are too parochial in thinking, you know. They don't have any foresight. They cannot see the, they cannot understand the fact that, you know, films can be shown outside of Manila or the Philippines. It's, again, the culture, the Filipino culture of quick rich, this quick rich mentality. They have no patience. Unlike the other ethnic minorities, like the Chinese, for example, they're very, very patient. You know, but Filipinos are not like that. You know, they want their money back with a big, you know, profit tomorrow. So, but because if you plan to show your film, or if the, you know, the bulwark of the market is abroad, then you have to be patient, you have to wait, you know. Like for Gatas and Merkava, these two films are going to run to the festival, and now it's beginning to be noticed, and hopefully there will be distributors very soon.
Are you distributing in like a rest of Asia, like Southeast Asia, other places?
No, because there is no market for art films in this country. You know, you can be invited in some special screenings there, but you don't really make money. You know, the market's still in America and in Europe.
For art films?
Yes.
So do you plan to have it released on video eventually?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it will be released in video.
Maybe next year or
soon, I hope.
Oh, great! Yeah, because I think I'm a librarian at a university, and we actually buy a lot of Asian films for students to watch, or teachers to use, and there is an independent distribution network that we get stuff from different vendors. Yeah. So you, right now you're working on a project to uncover this historical massacre in the Philippines. Maybe you could tell our listeners what that involved. Why you became interested in that that historical event?
Well, of course, as I mentioned during the beginning of this interview, I'm always interested in history. And when I say history, it doesn't mean, you know, stories or events that took place decades ago. But anyway, in this particular instance, I was fascinated, and my fascination started in mid-80s, you know, with an event called the Balangiga Massacre. Balangiga is a town in the south. It's actually in the Visayas Island, in the island of Samar, and it's officially known as the first Melai. Melai is a town in Vietnam. It's a village in Vietnam, actually, where Americans slaughtered, massacred children and grown-ups, you know, during the Vietnam War. It became, you know, a classic experience of the Vietnam-American War, you know. The same event took place in the Philippines in this little town of Balangiga exactly at the turn of the century, 1901. It's an unknown facet of the history of the conflict between the Filipinos and the Americans. And it is very dramatic, and it's very, very poignant. 74 Americans were, not all of them, but two of them survived. During the conflict, during the encounter between the Filipinos and the Americans, 74 Americans arrived in this peaceful town, and the soldiers started looting, raping, and, you know, committing all the atrocities that are associated with war. And these Filipinos couldn't, you know, wait anymore.
They fought back.
They fought back. And then when the Americans were defeated and massacred, the American forces came back with the instruction, the famous instruction from General Jacob Smith to turn the province into a howling wilderness and no one will be spared. He said that, "I don't want prisoners, I want them killed." And when he was asked the age limitation for those who would be killed, he said 10 years old. And the soldiers were so shocked that they were killing 10-year-olds, you know, young boys.
So initially they killed like several hundred people maybe in the first encounter? Uh-huh. I see different estimates of...
In the first encounter between the Americans and the...
You're listening to an interview with Gil Portes, director of Filipino films, that were showing at the Newport Beach Film Festival earlier this year. This interview was taped then, and we'll bring you the second part of the interview where he goes more in depth about this massacre that the U.S. was involved in early 19th century, about 100 years ago. Early 20th century, about 100 years ago at this island, and his film will be called The Bells of Balangiga, and it refers to the bells that were stolen from the Philippines by the U.S. military, and the inhabitants there now want it back. And if you go to the KUCI Subversity website, there'll be a link on the press release to different groups that are working to try to claim these bells back, and also a link to the writings of Mark Twain, who also spoke out in his Anti-Imperialist League at the time, speaking out against this atrocity. This is Dan Tsang. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. We're going to go back in a sec to the interview with Gil Portes. And if you stay tuned, this is Subversity with KUCI here on KUCI.
As young as 10 years old.
Yes. The order was given by this infamous General Jacob Smith. He told his commander that, you know, to turn Samar into a howling. He instructed his commander to turn Samar into a howling wilderness. And men as young as 10 years old should be killed. He said that he didn't want prisoners, he wanted them killed.
So how many people were massacred totally, you think?
Well, according to records, during the four-year Filipino-American War, 1 million Filipinos perished. And during the 300 years that we were under the Spaniards, and there was also revolution, less than 20,000 people died.
So this followed the Spanish-American War, and then there was a Filipino-American War. I understand that was when the term "gook" was first used. When was that used, you think?
During the Filipino-American War, when they came to, you know, when they came to the Philippines.
What?
Goose. I don't really know how to pronounce it. Goo.
What did that mean? What was the derivation of that, you think? The Americans, why would they call it?
I don't really know, but it's certainly it's not a term of endearment.
Most Americans think it was used first used in the Vietnam War, but that's not true.
No, it was used in the Philippines. So the Philippines was the first Vietnam, actually.
That's true, yeah. And a lot of films were made about the Vietnam War in the Philippines, right?
Yes. No, because the vegetation It's similar to Vietnam.
The terrain.
It's the terrain, you know, it was very easy to duplicate Vietnam in the country, you know. Some of his best films were made there, Platoon, Hamburger Hill, even Apocalypse Now.
You work on those, some of those?
Yeah, I work actually, well, for a week. As in Apocalypse, I work as a production assistant for a week, but I had to leave because I was scheduled to do my first film, to shoot my first film. I was there as an observer. You know, I wanted to see how Marlon Brando worked.
How was he?
He was big. And, you know, the great Coppola was a little scared of him, you know.
Was Mrs. Coppola documenting the whole thing?
Yeah. In fact, I saw that documentary years ago. It was beautiful.
Yeah. She was right there. And then, did you work with Oliver Stone too?
No.
So, do you think that, I guess the audience, I guess they use Filipinos to play Vietnamese then, must be. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a thing. It's bred for these Filipinos, you know. And it really shows the versatility of the Filipinos. They can be Vietnamese. Last year, there was a Dutch television production outfit who did a series in the Philippines about the Indonesian-Dutch war. And Filipinos appeared as Indonesians. The Year of Living Dangerously was shot in its entirety in the Philippines, directed by what's the name of this guy? It's Australian director.
I forget.
Well, anyway, and again, Filipinos were used as an Indonesian.
So you're saying that surf scene in the Apocalypse Now, surfing scene, was actually in the Philippines? Or was it was supposed to be based on China Beach in Vietnam?
Yeah, that was shot in the Philippines. Everything was shot in the Philippines, yeah.
So, what's the attitude of people there now? I mean, you're going to resurrect a historical period when the Americans were the invaders. Filipinos must have a love-hate relationship with the U.S.
Yes, it is love-hate relationship, you know. The Americans left the country years ago. The bases were closed, no? The two famous bases, the Clark Airfield and the Subic bases were shut down. But the Americans are back now with the they call that the Joint Forces Agreement between the Philippine military and the U.S. military. They are now in the process of, the Americans rather are now in the process of teaching Filipino soldiers on how to fight in this, you know, high-tech war, especially the search for the, you know, for the members of the Al-Qaeda cell who are based in the Philippines. But some of the activists in the country, not some, but the activists or the leftists in the country, think that this is only a ploy of the Americans to, you know, to gain a foothold again.
It's like another Vietnam, they bring up the Vietnam analogy.
Yes, to a certain extent. It's like another Vietnam, but they're concentrating their activities in the south where the secessionist Muslim groups are based.
So is that opposition getting support from the rest of the country, or is it just limited to the left sector?
Well, I'm afraid it's limited to the left sector because of the Abu Sayyaf. The Abu Sayyaf is allegedly a cell of the Al-Qaeda, and they did so much harm, you know. They kidnapped, they killed people, you know, and they accepted ransom money. So they're not really welcomed by the general population.
So is the other group that was doing the NPA, is it? Is that still around?
Yes, the NPAs are still around, although their forces were weakened, you know, but still a force to reckon with.
Do you ever want to make movies about them?
The NPA?
Or the supposed cell of Al-Qaeda?
Yes, well, yeah, there's a chance. I'm sure there are beautiful stories that can be dramatized on the screen, but I don't really support them, you know.
Do you ever feel in fear of your life for any movie you've made?
What do you mean?
Are you afraid? I mean, with people so mad at you for some film you made that they want to hurt you or no?
Actually, I was brought to court already for one of the films I did. It's a film called The Kite. I do not know if you saw that film, no?
No, I haven't seen it, but it's about a boy whose father was a policeman.
Yes. And he saw the policeman shooting another boy. It's a very simple film. And I got scared, not of the policeman, but the parents of the real boy sued me in the court for stealing the life story of the boy without their permission. And when the film was shown to the judge, the parents admitted that this is not the story of the boy.
Because the parents were not the police, or what?
No. That story, well, of course, I have to admit it was inspired by real life events, but it's not really the story of the boy. So I did not violate any, you know, whatchamacallit this. I did not infringe on their privacy, you know. So there was a settlement.
So it was settled out of court, or?
Yes, out of court.
So, how about in terms of censorship, or the fact that Philippines is such a Catholic society, is it hard to, for instance, in the bosom to show the breasts or show sucking on the breasts?
I was fortunate that when In the Bosom was submitted to the board was a little bit liberal and progressive, but when Gloria Macapagal took over as president of the country, things changed, you know. She appointed a very conservative and an old man, actually, someone who's in his mid-70s to head the board. So you can imagine the kind of films that they will approve or disapprove. But now there's a clamor for liberalism, and they are slowly giving in to the audience.
Because I remember from just living in Hong Kong before that, I hear stories that when there was a film festival, like foreign films that went to Philippines, some of them couldn't get in because of
censorship. Yeah. And these foreign producers refuse to show the film if they are heavily censored.
So that doesn't happen as much now, or still?
Not anymore. Especially for festivals, they're quite lenient.
So I understand that it was a previous regime that was involved with your production company for the... Was it Estrada? Had something to do with your production company for the previous film?
Well, Joseph Estrada was really a producer before he entered politics. Right. The family was in the movie business. In fact, the producer of In the Bosom of the Enemy is a brother of Joseph Estrada.
So did that have an effect on the distribution later? Or?
No. You know, they are originally in the movie business, so he became president, so what has it got to do with, you know, with their business?
So when he was out, what happened? I mean, that nothing happened to the production company, or?
Well, nothing. They're still producing films.
Wow, that was fast.
So I know one of the films you did document make a film about the People's Revolution, one of the films was about the revolt, the People's Revolt. Was one of your early films about the People's Movement in the Philippines?
I did a film called Andrea, starring Nora Honor, one of the country's best actresses. And it's a story of the left, the friendship of this woman who is a communist rebel, and a fellow and a friend of hers in college. It's basically, it's a melodrama, but it's the backdrop is the movement of the communists.
So was that well received?
It was well received. Oh, yeah. It was well received. Yes, I did a film called Birds of Prey. I forgot.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, it's about what happened in the country after Cory Aquino took over. You know, yeah. It's from the point of view of an expat who goes back to search for her daughter. She left behind, and the father is a communist rebel. And you know, it's actually from her point of view. The story is narrated from her point of view as she looks at the country again, and she was sad to say, to conclude, that nothing has changed after Cory, you know, took over.
So the corruption and all that was still.
I think still there.
How do you see yourself as politically?
Politically, I will never be involved in politics, meaning I will not run for a public office. But it doesn't mean I will be quiet, you know. I speak out. I support candidates who are attuned or who will work for the welfare of the masses.
Do you stand out among the top Filipino filmmakers? Are they all on the same kind of side? Or are some more like bourgeois, I guess?
Who?
Some of the filmmakers more bourgeois, like, are they just into it for making films, but they're not, they want to take political stance?
Well, some of the important directors in the country take political stand, but some good directors are also wishy-washy when it comes to their political beliefs, you know. It's where the wind blows. Now it's Gloria Macapagal, so, you know, Gloria Macapagal is that. Before it was Joseph Estrada, you know, it's, they don't really have a definite political stand. You know, it's where the wind blows.
So is that, does that help you, or does it make it harder for you to get funding, I guess?
No, not really. Not really.
They know where you stand, but it doesn't.
Yes.
It's fine. Do you think this? You think like Hollywood or some distributor here would be interested in your next film about the Balang Giga?
Balang Giga, I think so. Yesterday I had a meeting with an executive of Sony Pictures, and he sounded very enthusiastic about the project. We're hoping to get additional funding from them.
Because, you know, right now the films they're showing now are since 9/11 are very patriotic, American patriotic. But I guess time will change, you know, there'll be another period when there'll be more critical films.
Yes, but, you know, I think the Balang Giga film is very relevant to the 9/11. Americans, I always say this, Americans should look deeper, you know, and ask questions, why did 9/11 happen?
Yeah.
Of course, we don't want it to be repeated, no. Nobody, I do not know, I don't endorse the 9/11 event, no, but at the same time, I will pause for a little while and I will ask myself, why did this happen? You know, Americans should really, really dig deeper. Because most Americans, majority of the Americans, think that they are the most benevolent creature in the world. You know, why is this happening to them? But, you know, I can be accused of being anti-American. I live in New York. I love this country so much, you know. I spent some of the best years of my life here. My children, you know, made it here, you know. But it doesn't mean that you're anti-American if you start questioning policies of America, right?
Right. And so you're implying that it's American foreign policy has something to do with it.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I don't have to elaborate.
Right. How about the, in terms of back to the Balang Giga massacre, there's still a sore in Philippine-American relations, right? The Philippines wants the kind of trophies from that were handed back to the Philippines.
Yes, actually, one attraction for me is the the question of the bells, which were taken by the Americans and are now on display in a military museum in Wyoming. Two bells are on display in the military museum in Wyoming, and one bell is in a military U.S. military base in Korea. And these bells must be returned, just to put a closure to this.
The argument is that the bells were used by the rebels in the town.
Yes, the bells were used as an instrument of war. The bells were used to signal the beginning of the war, and because most of the rebels were hiding in the forest, and at the time there were no walkie-talkies or radios to give them the sign to attack. So the only way to do that was to ring the bells. And the bells of Balangiga, the old bells, were so powerful that they can be heard 8 kilometers away. That's what the old folks were telling us during our research. So the bells were used as the signal for the attack. And as a result, they were branded as instruments of war, and they were confiscated.
So the Philippines trying to get it back for its anniversary?
Yeah, during the 100-year anniversary of the independence of the Philippines some years ago, I heard that President Clinton offered a compromise agreement, wherein one of the bells will be returned and the other bell will stay in Wyoming. And this was, I think, acceptable to the Philippines. But I forgot the name of the senator of Wyoming who pointed out that is not possible because of the law prohibiting the return of instruments of war, and the bells are classified as instruments of war.
So there's the war booty. They get to keep it. So do you think how are you going to depict this? Have you thought about how you're going to show this incident? Is it focusing on individuals involved, or how? Or is it
the film is focusing on the individuals who participated in the in the conflict, Americans and Filipinos. We're trying to be very factual about it, but of course there are some fictional events that we are including in the film.
So it will start shooting next year?
No, we start July.
Oh wow, already?
Well, we are in pre-production now.
So how long usually? I know you said that In the Bosom took only 16 days to film.
16. No, but this one it's going to be a minimum 50 shooting days for the bells. This is a big film.
Do you have to balance the look at the weather? I know some of the scenes in these two films you showed. I guess the one in the Bosom showed. Or was it? In the Bosom showed the rain, a lot of rain. Was that artificially created, or was that real rain?
Those are artificial rain.
So, but when you film in the Philippines, you must have to worry about monsoons and stuff.
Yeah,
typhoons.
That is included in the planning. But it doesn't rain so much now because of El Nino. Yeah.
Okay. And also, maybe when it rains, it clears away fast. Is that right? So, who are you going to have play the Americans? Do you know yet?
I do not know yet, but we're looking at. I was even joking the other day that, I wanted Russell Crowe to play Jacob Smith, but since he lost the Oscar, I changed my mind. Oh, we do not know yet, but I am not at liberty to tell you, but we're considering some names.
So big names.
No, not really. Like, for example, I might as well tell you, I like John Malkovich to play the general who gave the order. It's a cameo role, actually. It's only a day shoot, And John Malkovich is known to be sympathetic to independent filmmakers. Maybe he'll accept it. I don't know.
Yeah. So, so this should be done. You said 50 days. So you were on the set, I guess, last week doing something else. Doing another.
I am currently shooting a movie when I need another 2-3 days to finish the film. It's a film called Small Voices. It's a story of a newly graduate young teacher who decided to teach in the rural area. And, you know, had a culture shock when she saw the, you know, when the realities of the town or the village were presented to him. She was about to give up and just go to the States where her mother is, you know, leaving. But there was an invitation from the central school to compete in a singing competition. So against all odds, she organized a singing group. They competed, you know, in a singing competition, and they won. Wow. It's as simple as that, you know.
Yeah.
But it's quite poignant, and, you know, you can see the plight of the children, working children, actually, being used by their parents to work in the farms, you know, and neglecting their, you know, their studies. And teachers who have lost their, you know, their idealism because of the meager pay and because of the overall economic situation. It can be an important film.
It's Markova film. Did all the actors, all the Dolphy and his two sons, they all won an award at Brussels?
Yes, they did. There is this Brussels in the Independent Film Festival. They were so impressed with them that they were named best actors, at the same time best actress, you know. They decided not to award the best actress to a legitimate woman.
So all three won?
Yes, all of them won.
Is it hard to find? I guess it's not that hard to find people to play gay roles, huh?
In the Philippines,
no.
Some people accuse the U.S. of trying to export like gay liberation to other countries. I mean, do you see it as more a generic thing do people try to do? I mean, like, how do you see the gay movement over in the Philippines?
Oh, well, although the Philippines is a Catholic country, the gay movement is quite strong.
And is it in some way similar to what's happening here? Do people try to come out and all that stuff?
Well, no, not really. It's not like what you have here, no, but, you know, during the gay week, they have a gay parade, but they are not asserting themselves yet, not yet, you know, politically, you know, in the political arena or in other sectors, but they're gaining some strength.
Because I've been going to Vietnam a lot and also Hong Kong, and it's totally different there. I mean, there are lots of gays there, of course, but they don't see it as, I guess it's more a practice rather than an identity thing, I guess I'll call it. Do you think that's
You're right. It's more of a practice rather than an identity.
Because I know the New York Times even just did a story about China, and they said most of the people in these gay bars were married, and so they were going to hang out at the gay bar, but they actually had wives back home. And so, do you think that's very common in the Philippines too?
No, that's not common in the Philippines. That's not common.
That's more accepting. Do you think people?
What I'm saying is. I do not know, but I don't think married men hung out in the gay bars. I don't think they do.
But do people tend to? I know in Vietnam, people who I know who are gay, they tend to think of gays just as kind of effeminate people. But is that the general position on gay people in Philippines?
To a certain extent, that's the perception.
Yeah,
you know, to a certain extent.
But do you think they will try to get like legislation passed or non-discrimination stuff? Or is that coming up? Or what do you think?
I don't think so, and it will take a long time before legislations like this are approved or even considered.
So right now, partly because of the strong Catholic stronghold,
yes.
Are there any sex scandals there involving priests? Is in the U.S. there's such a big deal here?
Yeah, there are, but they're not blatant. You don't see them in the papers or in television news, you know, but there are.
That was our interview with Gil Portes, who's making a new film right now about U.S. atrocities in the turn of the century, last century, in the Philippines, U.S. military massacre of lots of civilians. Another My Lai. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.